From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. The numbers are staggering. Over 6,000 people killed in drug-related violence in Mexico last year. Now the war against the drug cartels is right at our doorstep. With gun battles on the streets of Tijuana, beheadings in Juarez, and contract killings happening across the Southwest, how should U.S. officials deal with the conflict? And how has this grim portrait affected tourism? And how can travelers stay out of danger? We now turn to Andrew Becker, a staff writer for the Center for Investigative Reporting, and Ken Ellingwood, a correspondent in the Mexico City Bureau of the Los Angeles Times and author of Hardline, Life and Death on the U.S.-Mexico Border. Gentlemen, welcome to News and Notes.
Pleased to be here.
Thank you.
Ken, let's start with you. Mexican President Felipe Calderon has said that this recent explosion of violence is a war. Let's talk about what this war is about. Is it just a matter of drugs and guns, or is something else involved here?
Well, I would say that it's really three different wars that are happening at the same time. And to really understand the level of violence, I think you really have to understand that. The government of Mexico initiated a war against organized crime a couple of years ago. That's been one of the big fronts in the war as Calderon sent troops and federal police out into the streets. The second war is one between drug cartels, which are fighting over turf and fighting over routes to get drugs into the United States. And then the third war that we're seeing, which is mainly along the border, is within drug trafficking organizations. There's sort of generational changes. Some of the old folks, leaders, have been either killed or sent off to prison. And you see power struggles within them, and which has led to a lot of the violence in places like Tijuana, for example. So there's different kinds of violence taking place all along the border and within Mexico.
Well, Andrew, how much does American demand for drugs play into this whole conflict and the wealth and power of the drug dealers in Mexico?
Well, I think you're seeing people on both sides of the border. Certainly the Mexicans have long said that the U.S. demand really is driving a lot of this. And I think more and more you're seeing people, politicians in D.C., acknowledging that the drug consumption in this country that funds the drug cartels to the tune of just billions and billions of dollars a year is really the biggest drug market in the world, and it's lucrative, and that's what the battle's for.
Now, Ken, you're in Mexico City right now. Is the Mexican government really working against the cartels? I ask that because a number of law enforcement personnel have been accused of working for the cartels, in fact, and it seems that it's hard to tell who the good guys are.
Yeah, that's often true down here. The problem of corruption is age-old in Mexico. The corruption within police agencies, the corruption within the prosecutor's office, even as going up to the level of the country's former drug czar, who has been accused of having colluded with one of the big drug trafficking groups in Sinaloa. It's a big problem in Mexico. It always has been. Calderon said, look, you know, we are the recent arrests that you've seen in Mexico, they are a sign that we are now finally getting a grip on this. We know we have a lot of work to do. The Calderon government has initiated a program to try to clean up the police, starting with the federal police. But a lot of the problem is at the local level with local municipal police and state police, and it is a very, very difficult problem to eradicate.
Well, Andrew, Mexico is a very popular tourist destination, and some American universities this year particularly have discouraged their students from making Mexico their spring break destination. Does the violence that is occurring, does it stay within the drug gangs, or is it spilling over into areas where travelers are at risk?
Well, there's been some areas. Cancun has had some problems, but for the most part, it stays away from the tourist areas. There's the rare occurrence where it might spill, but for the most part, it's staying outside. And people are still headed to Mexico. I mean, with the peso falling and the dollar strengthening, you can get a pretty big bang for your buck in Mexico.
Well, Ken, I know that you recently reported on some high-profile violence that it took place, in fact, in Cancun, which is the beach town that is quite popular with spring breakers, one of the many, actually, in Mexico. Tell us about that.
Well, I was there and wrote a story about the killing of a retired Army general who had been just hired to help clean up the city's police force. That city's police force, like many of them around Mexico, was, you know, had a corruption problem. The mayor brought in this this retired general to help reform the police. In his second day on the job, he was killed with two other people. Their bodies were found miles outside of the city. And it was sort of a reminder that in spite of all the postcard images of these places as being resorts and tourism spots, that there's another side to a lot of these tourist cities, and that other side, you know, is rife with violence and has, you know, drug dealing going on and the same kind of violence that you see in other places. I would completely back what Andrew said about the tourist zones. However, in Cancun, for example, you know, the spot where this former general was seized by gunmen and then later dumped is really, we're far away from where the tourists gather on the strip along the beach. And the same thing holds with a lot of other tourist areas. The tourism zones in Mexico tend to be very confined, and they tend to be quite distinct from the cities that they are really a part of. And if you go to some of these places as a tourist from the United States, you may spend the entire week never having really seen any real Mexicans except for the people who drive the taxi or the van to the resort and the people who work there, because they really are quite distinct. On that score, if it is if a person goes and travels in Mexico and minds their own business and uses common sense, the odds are that they're not going to have a problem.
But Andrew, that's a different situation, is it not, if you go to a place like Tijuana or if you go to Juarez, which are both border towns, and there have been a high number of reported deaths occurring in both of those cities.
It's really been the places where most of these drug-related killings have occurred. And again, for the most part, these killings are involving people who are in the drug trade, as Ken elaborated, warring or battling cartels that are killing each other. There has been this sort of encroaching lawlessness that has started to take over parts of Tijuana and Ciudad Juarez that might even be a potential, I don't know if I'd call it a full-out war, but perhaps a fourth front in this battle happening in Mexico. And that is where, because of the police forces being either widely corrupted or just really overtaken by the cartels, or in some places the military stepping in and enforcing the law, or at least concentrating on the cartels, that criminals, opportunists, are starting to turn toward the citizens and the residents of these towns. That has created a new migrant class of people, mostly middle class, upper middle class, who are unlike the traditional economic migrant, who are looking to come to the United States to really wait out this drug war.
You know, it's interesting you should mention that. Ken, I'm going to wind the conversation down with you on this point because we've already mentioned that you work for the LA Times. One of your colleagues, Hector Tobar, just wrote a column, in fact, about the border town Tijuana and the drug wars and the fears. And he talked about how the recession in the United States is creeping southward and impacting the lives of the people there. I asked that as a backdrop to this question. The Homeland Security officials are now saying that if the border problems continue to escalate, the U.S. may send National Guard troops to border towns. Is this likely to happen, and what impact do you think it will have?
It seems like a long shot at this point. There hasn't been the spillover yet in a big way that would provoke the United States government to send troops to the border. In the same comments in which President Obama said he would consider such a thing, he also said he has no interest in militarizing the border. Sending thousands of troops to the border would be a highly symbolic and pretty volatile action to take. And I think it would take some kind of serious incident of violence on the U.S. side of the border to provoke that kind of action.
Really briefly, this has never happened before, has it, the U.S. sending military troops to the border?
Well, I mean, you know, there have been various times when the, you know, the U.S. and Mexico back in, you know, in the olden days, you know, didn't get along so well. I mean, the U.S. sent troops along the border during the days of Pancho Villa during the Mexican Revolution. In modern and has, you know, sent troops to Mexico proper, you know, in earlier times. In modern times, the U.S. has sent National Guard troops to the border for the purpose of constructing the barrier that's been going up along the border.
All right,
not for patrol.
All right, I appreciate the information, gentlemen. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Andrew Becker is a staff writer for the Center for Investigative Reporting. He spoke to us from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Ken Ellingwood is a correspondent in the Mexico City Bureau of the Los Angeles Times and author of Hardline: Life and Death on the U.S.-Mexico Border. Just ahead, the president of Madagascar steps down, and the president of Sudan orders all foreign aid workers out. Our Africa update is next.
Hi, I'm Clarence Page, nationally syndicated columnist for the Chicago Tribune, and I've really appreciated News and Notes for giving us a more in-depth view of what goes on in Washington, but also how it has an effect on real people outside the Beltway.
This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Time now for our Africa update. After weeks of political tension, Madagascar's president steps down. What's next in the struggle for power on the Indian Ocean island? Plus, Somalia remains one of the most dangerous countries in the world for aid workers. And the president of Sudan says all foreign aid groups need to go. For more now, we have got Amira Woods. She is co-director of foreign policy and focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. And Bill Fletcher, a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and former president of Trans-Africa Forum. Amira, Bill, nice to have you back.
Great to be with you.
Glad to be on the program.
Here we go with Madagascar. The president says he is stepping down and handing power to the military just one day after soldiers stormed his presidential palace. Military leaders are reportedly going to transfer power directly to the opposition leader. So, Amira, let's come to you with this first off. What is the dispute about between these two men, and is this a coup?
Well, it is, for all intents and purposes, a coup. And for a while, it seemed like the military was actually going to take over with a naval admiral who was said to be in charge for some time. But now it seems like the military is handing over power. When Ravalomanana stepped down, they are now handing over power to the opposition leader, Rajoelina. And I think it is clearly a sense that people have had enough. Over 136 people have been killed since January. There's just a sense of disconnect with the ordinary citizens there on the streets in Madagascar. There is abject economic strife going on, like in many countries around the world. But in Madagascar, there was a sense that, yes, there would be new possibilities with new foreign interests in economic sectors like mining and elsewhere that could bring a sense of improved livelihood for people. And that has not materialized. So I think there's been a disconnect with ordinary people's needs and a sense that things have gone awry. And so this has pushed now a political crisis process. So clearly there will be a transition period. It is said that within 18 to 24 months, there will be an election that takes place. We will see if that timetable still holds. But there is worrying concerns that as militaries are increasing their influence and power, not only in Madagascar, but around the continent, you are seeing these sometimes bloodless, but very much coups taking place from place to place.
Well, Bill Fletcher, my question is Ravalo Manana, is he responsible for this?
I don't think that you could say necessarily that. I actually want to pick up on something that Amira was just pointing to. No matter how bad the situation is, this introduction of the military as a way of resolving the situation becomes problematic. It may seem to offer an immediate solution, and in this sense, it probably offers a temporary respite. The problem, though, is the long-term the issue of long-term democratic institutions, which end up being frustrated. You had a very similar situation in Mauritania a few months ago with a coup where there were allegations of corruption and a number of other things, and the military intervened with some level of popular support. But nevertheless, it is a military coup. The democratic institutions do not deepen their roots. They become very fragile.
Well, let's move on to Somalia, because in East Africa, yesterday, four United Nations aid workers were abducted and then freed hours later in south central Somalia. This coming, of course, just weeks after Somali Islamist insurgents killed 11 AU peacekeepers in the capital city of Mogadishu. Amira, Somalia's new president, Sheikh Sharif Ahmed Ahmed, is attempting to establish government control in the country and to gain the support of the Islamist insurgents. But my question is, what are these kidnappings really about?
Well, clearly there is very much an insurgency going on in Somalia. There's a sense it's the same story, it seems, Tony, you know, of like people not having their will represented in the political process. And I think in Somalia there was, you know, first a government put in place outside the country, and now a government put in place that still is not necessarily seen as representative of the people. And so you have a sense that things are still not right, that the governance situation has been so manipulated by outside forces. And the worry is that the U.S. has had such a heavy hand in selecting the leadership and the governing parties there in Somalia that the Somali people actually have a sense of disconnect and distrust. So what you see still with the targeting of aid workers in particular, I mean, is a sense that these uprisings have not yet subsided because the will of the people has still not been met. So there has got to be an opportunity for Somalis to control their own destiny, to choose their own leaders freely, and then to hold those leaders accountable. And I think there's a sense that it has not yet arrived at that point in Somalia because, again, the U.S. And their proxies, Ethiopia and others, have had a heavy hand in selecting the leadership there in Somalia.
Well, complicating things, it would seem, Bill, there and elsewhere on the continent, United Nations Security Council recently, for example, clearing the way for the establishment of a UN peacekeeping force in Somalia. But the peacekeeping forces have been running into trouble all over the place. Are regional peacekeeping forces the problem?
The problem with many of these peacekeeping forces is that they are under-resourced. So it's you're sending, in many cases, an insufficient number of troops with a lack of the kind of weaponry that they need and a lack of a full and clear mandate as to their responsibilities into a very chaotic situation. Because in addition to what Amira was just saying, you also have criminal activity that is going on and the activities of warlords. So you have the Islamists who are themselves very divided. You have criminal actors that are in play there that create a very unstable situation for the people of the country, not to mention for the humanitarian workers.
You also have, Tony, a region that is awash in weapons. And we have to say, many of those weapons, some, you know, come from other regions of the world, but many of those weapons originate right here in the United States. And when you have more guns and you have people, you will continue to have crises like this emerge and will continue unabated.
You know, there's another flashpoint we should talk about taking place on the continent. In Sudan, of course, it's been just a few weeks since the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for President Omar al-Bashir on charges of war crimes in Darfur. Amira, Bill, we have been talking about this, you know, week after week after week, it seems. Now he says he wants all international aid groups out of the country within a year. And last week he kicked out 13 foreign agencies, mostly from Darfur, including Oxfam and Save the Children. How is this playing out, Bill? It seems like very high stakes poker with people's lives at stake.
Well, this actually relates to something we talked about, I think, last week, man, where this arrest warrant, I think, was absolutely incorrect. It may have been morally justified, but I'm not sure that anyone thought through the consequences unless you can go in and literally pick up this guy, and grab him and pull him out of the country. And even then, as I said last week, there is a regime in place. This is not just an individual. So, of course, an arrest warrant is being issued. His back is up against the wall, and now he's lashing out. Why should this surprise anybody?
So this is probably where my brother and I take different ends of this. I'm, you know, Tony, just getting back from Liberia last night, and this issue of the arrest warrant was a raging discussion on the streets of Liberia. Clearly, you know, the Charles Taylor example, where an indictment and followed by an arrest of one individual can go a long way towards bringing peace and holding people accountable at all levels. And I think that's often, there's this false debate being set up. You know, do we want peace or do we want justice? And what you hear time and time again is that people want both. There's got to be a way to hold accountable those who commit gross atrocities against, you know, ordinary civilians. And there's got to be a way to hold even those in the highest offices, including those, you know, not just in Africa, but in many other regions of the world, including here in the U.S., accountable for their actions that are inhumane, unjust, and immoral. And I think there's a sense that this indictment, while it is controversial, it is in keeping with setting up an international rules-based system and then holding everyone accountable to that system.
Well, you know, that brings me to Barack Obama. But before I ask the question about that, I want to remind our listeners that this is News and Notes, and I'm Tony Cox, and we are talking in our Africa update with Amira Woods, co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, and Bill Fletcher, a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and a former president of Trans-Africa Forum. As you know, this is our last time doing Africa Update. Our show is going off the air after Friday. And both of you have been participating on the show since 2002, and you've been through several incarnations of it, and I want to get your reflections on what you think the importance of what we do, we meaning all of us, in terms of trying to get the word out about Africa. But before you do that, let's go back to talk about Barack Obama, because there are a lot of people thinking that with his election, there will be a new direction and a new light shined on Africa. Some may disagree with that. What would you suggest, Bill Fletcher, to the president in terms of issues that he should address immediately on the continent?
Well, quite a number of issues. One is the need to demilitarize the continent. The whole AFRICOM issue. I mean, Africa needs more weapons the way we need smallpox. I mean, it's just it needs to be a demilitarized situation, and the United States should not be encouraging any further militarization. That's one thing. A second thing is around HIV/AIDS, much greater commitment by the United States to the UN's program, not Bush's pet program that existed, that I think was fundamentally in competition with the UN's effort. So I think that's a second thing. A third thing is a much closer relationship with the African Union In terms of peacekeeping and working towards settlements, for example, in the Great Lakes region, or as we were talking about in the Horn of Africa. I mean, we need to have capable, objective people deployed. And it's a long-term commitment, whether you're talking about those regions or you're talking about the Western Sahara. You need to have a long-term commitment of resources and individuals backed up by the White House. So I think that those are several things that need to happen.
Briefly, Amira, what are your thoughts? I know that you've been you've talked quite a bit about AFRICOM on this program over the years.
Absolutely, and I say here to Bill's genius on that one, because I think it is the dominant scene right now in terms of U.S.-Africa relations. There has been a Senate committee hearing today, a House committee hearing tomorrow, and the following day, focused on AFRICOM. And I think it is important for listeners to understand that AFRICOM was sort of the send-off gift from the Bush administration that really must be closely examined by the Obama administration. And it is incumbent on taxpayers, on members of Congress, to play their role in asking questions to make sure that prioritizing a relationship with Africa's militaries does not end up actually harming, bringing much more harm than good, and putting a military face towards U.S. engagement with the continent. We've gone down that road many, many times before. It would be disastrous to go there again. I think the other issue is around Africa's resources. Africa is incredibly rich, and when you see especially the oil that is now coming to the U.S., the cobalt from the Great Lakes region that powers our cell phones and computers, the U.S. needs to begin to engage with Africa in a different way, as an equal partner in trade that brings fair trade, really, that remembers the needs of workers and the needs of the environment, in creating these trading relationships. So I think it is renegotiating a relationship, downplaying the military far differently than it is now, and increasing opportunities in which to engage in the continent in ways that bring benefit to the continent and not more destruction. I think those are the critical elements that could, begin to put in place a new type of engagement between an Obama administration and the African continent.
We are down to our very last minute of Africa Update. So, Bill, any reflections?
I think this is an incredibly sad day, and it's probably reflected in my voice in this interview, that this program has been exceptional in raising issues that the mainstream media by and large ignores. When it comes to Africa, the treatment is extremely superficial, and I think that NPR was to be applauded for having this program, and I'm hoping and praying that wisdom emerges somewhere, and that they realize the need to restart this effort.
30 seconds for you, Amira.
There's none other than News and Notes that provided a space for stories, in-depth stories on Africa on a weekly basis, but also provided an opportunity to not just talk about the negative side, but to have positive images of Africa coming out to mainstream America. This is a gift that News and Notes provided for the country, for the world, that many of us are really saddened now at the loss of such a valued treasure for this nation.
On behalf of the staff of News and Notes, I want to thank both of you for participating in Africa Update and for sharing with us and for sharing with our audience. Thank you again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for all your vision and work.
Amira Woods is co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. Bill Fletcher is a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and the former president of Trans-Africa Forum. He's also the co-author of Solidarity Divided, The Crisis in Organized Labor and a New Path Towards Social Justice. They both joined us from our studios in Washington, D.C. Next on News and Notes, we peer behind the scenes of our show. Two producers remember a few of their favorite segments.
I'm Julianne Malvo, president of Bennett College for Women in Greensboro, North Carolina. Vital, vigorous, fantastic, and exceptional. That's what News and Notes has meant to me. I've been part of the contributing team since its inception and have enjoyed it. We'll miss it and know the listeners will as well.
I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. This week, I'm going to be talking with the people who work behind the scenes here at News and Notes about their best experiences getting this show on air. First, we turn to Devin Robbins, who's been producing our Africa segments for the past couple of years. Hi, Devin.
Hi, Tony.
You know, I wanted to ask you, what was your reaction when you were first assigned this?
I have to admit, I didn't know much about the continent. It seemed a really faraway place, and I was a bit hesitant.
Well, now you've become an expert. You've done hundreds, literally hundreds of these segments, haven't you?
I have.
Any stand out?
Yeah, you know, there's a couple that stand out to me. And one I haven't been able to shake is the story that we did on albinos being murdered in Tanzania. And I was reading a blog one day, and I saw a very short blurb at the bottom about this. And I thought, well, I'm going to look into this a little bit more. And was able to track down the reporter. And it turns out her name is Vicky Entetema. She's the BBC bureau chief in Tanzania. And she had written this story because more than 24 albinos had been murdered in about a 9-month period of time. And she felt like nobody was really paying attention.
And how, and the way that and why they were murdered also made it interesting, didn't it?
It did, because apparently witch doctors in that area, that part of East Africa, believe that albinos have special powers and that they can make you more successful in business and such. So, you know, there's some cultural history to it as well. And it took me a couple weeks to track her down. And when I found her, she was in hiding in Kenya. She had fled Tanzania after her life was threatened. And I found her in a hut in Kenya on her cell phone.
Yes, I'm out of the country right now. And I don't know how safe I am in Tanzania, but because of these threats, the BBC authority said that I should get out for a while and let things cool down. If they come and kill me, the report is out, the witch doctors have been exposed, at least I would say I died for a good cause, and maybe one less albino person would die.
The number of albinos murdered since we ran our story has risen to 45, but the president of Tanzania has urged people to tell on the killers so that they can try to bring them to justice.
Well, you know, there are many different kinds of stories, and that was a very serious and dark story. But you've also done a lot of musicians, and there's a lot of music coming out of that continent, right?
Yeah.
Anybody stand out for you?
Yeah. The music pieces are one of my favorite to do. I'm a big music fan. I like to hear the reasons behind people's songs. A lot of the African musicians we've spoken to have had some pretty dark times, and that's where their music comes from. And one that stands out for me is a gentleman named Emmanuel Jal, who was a child soldier since the age of 8. He fought with the Sudan People's Liberation Army, and after about 4 years, he was smuggled by a missionary to Kenya, where he was able to, I guess, regain his childhood and begin to start a new life. And here's what he told us about that time as a child soldier.
My escape, you know, and when the things were really horrible, you know, you kind of sometimes want to lose hope. Will this war ever end? What's going to happen? And my trek in the desert wasn't easy, you know, seeing some of my friends die. And watching somebody starving to death, it's not a good thing, because somebody becomes skinny. And also me getting tempted even to eat one of my best friend because there was no food, and the cannibalism that broke out there.
Wow.
What he does is he raps in his songs about those experiences, which if you listen closely, you can hear were pretty traumatic. And that's where the strength of his music came from.
You've been responsible for setting up a number of interviews. Some I've done, some Farai Chidea did. Talk about some of the more memorable ones.
I think for me, you're always amazed at the regular type of people that you can get on the air to tell their stories. But it's also a thrill to be able to book heads of state. And I've had the privilege of being able to book several African heads of state. And one that stands out for me was in June, we spoke with Zimbabwean opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai. He won the primary election that happened last year. There was issues over ballots and counting and such, and refused to be in a runoff election with Robert Mugabe because his supporters were being targeted by the Mugabe government, as he put it. And we were able to talk with him back in June during the violence that was going on prior to the power-sharing agreement. And we asked him about several things, but what stood out to me was what he had to say about his political nemesis.
Robert Mugabe invokes these conflicting emotions. There are some who forgive him for what he has done after independence, which is horrendous and unforgivable. But there are others who also know Robert Mugabe as a patriotic Zimbabwean committed to the freedom of the people. For me, I think that the first decade of independence, Robert Mugabe was my hero. I think he deteriorated, and I don't know what has made him to transform from a hero to a villain, and now to a real tyrant, and I think it's very unfortunate.
You know, earlier this month, as we covered on News and Notes, Morgan Tsvangirai was injured in a car accident. His wife, Susan, was killed, and there's been some suspicion about the accident, but Morgan Tsvangirai himself has come out and said that he will continue to work with the power-sharing government, so we can just see what happens with that.
You interviewed another head of state. Who was that?
In October of 2008, we were able to interview Jacob Zuma, who, as you know, is the head of the African National Congress. That's the party that was led by Nelson Mandela. What was important and interesting about this conversation was that Jacob was in the midst of a corruption trial. Also, just a few weeks before this interview, his party, the ANC, the African National Congress, had just ousted South African President Thabo Mbeki, who had succeeded Nelson Mandela. So there was some serious things going on. We were really surprised to get the interview. We were more surprised that he was as outspoken and honest in answering the questions that we asked him. Here's what he said about race relations in South Africa.
South Africa comes from a very divided racially kind of society, wherein racism, more than any other country, was institutionalized. And we had to tackle this from the beginning and indeed establish a new nation, which we call the Rainbow Nation. And I think people who raise the issue of race or ethnicity as a major problem in South Africa, they are actually exaggerating the situation.
Let me ask you one other question, Devin, because
okay.
You've done really great work, which all of us at News and Notes appreciate, myself particularly, because I work on these Africa updates with you a lot of times. It has become, I suspect, a part of who you are now. Am I right about that?
Yeah.
Share the story of waking up in the middle of the night.
Being a producer at NPR, you get to cover a lot of different things. But I have to say Africa has been my main focus, mostly because of the time difference and the amount of time it takes to bring these stories to air. So I take a lot of it home with me. And I woke up the other night in a cold sweat. And my husband woke up after I jumped up out of the bed, and he asked me what was wrong. And I said I had had a nightmare. And he said, well, what was the nightmare about? And I said, I was being chased by the Janjaweed. He looked at me with a real puzzled look. And he says, I'm not sure what that is. But it seems like you're awfully scared. The Janjaweed are known as the devils on horseback. They're these armed militiamen in Darfur who have victimized and terrorized that population. And I guess I have done enough stories where they're involved and read up on it enough that it was in my subconscious and they were chasing me.
Well, we're glad it was just a dream.
Yeah, me too.
Devin, thank you very much.
Thanks, Tony, for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Devin Robbins is an 11-year veteran producer and director here at NPR and has been the sole producer on News & Notes Africa segments for more than 2 years. You can find links to all of the stories Devin talked about at our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. Now we're going to turn to Zachary Slowbig. He is another producer here on News & Notes. Hey, Zach.
Hey, Tony.
So you regularly handle our economics coverage on the show, and it's been an extraordinary time to cover the financial world, of course. Whole industries contracting and changing forever. The auto industry, an obvious example. Our own industry, the media, another example. But a few months ago, you found a worker from another industry that is reeling from the recession. Tell us about her.
Well, Tony, this was back in mid-December, and Farai Chidea, the former host of News & Notes, and I were working on a segment about workplace identity, about race and gender roles in the workplace. And I had found a few folks that I thought might be interesting, and I took them into our midday meeting here, which we have every day at noon. And, between the group, we decided these weren't the right folks, and Farai insisted, we should really find a worker. We should talk to a worker. How about a female longshoreman or something like that? So I went out, had a few more hours in the day, and tried my best. And sure enough, I did find a female longshoreman. I found the Longshore and Warehouse Union's newsletter online. It's called The Dispatcher. And that's where I found Clova Jean Good. And she was one of the first women working here on the waterfront in the ports of Long Beach and Los Angeles, the nation's busiest. So I talked to her, and I got her to come in the next day and go live on the show. And Farai sort of started the conversation off asking about her father, who was also a longshoreman, and asked what her father's response was to her desire to follow in his footsteps.
Oh, he did not want that. He did not want his daughter on the waterfront. He felt that he had struggled long and far enough, and that he didn't want me in that type of environment.
Why did you want to do it?
Because I was, like I say, apple don't fall too far from the tree. I knew that it was a great career. I knew that it was excellent money, and I knew that I could become a great independent woman, help myself and help others. So I had plenty of challenging days where I had to fight for my rights.
What do you mean by that? What do you mean by fight for your rights?
Well, I took on my employer. I went ahead and I sued them, and I did what I had to do to break the glass ceiling so that women, African-American women, and everyone can have an equal employment opportunity.
Now, Zach, I remember her being here, but what I also remember was her father, who sat on the other side of the glass here watching his daughter. He had this really proud face, proud expression on his face. Tell us about him.
Yeah, her father's name was Clovey Good, and he did accompany her to the interview that day. He had come to L.A. back in 1956 from Jasper, Texas, and he soon found work down on the docks as what's known as a casual. He picked up shifts as a longshoreman. And over the course of a few minutes, found out that he had been one of the first black crane operators down on the docks back in the late 50s. So I chatted with him and sort of coaxed him into sticking around and doing another interview with Farai and his daughter after the show. And Farai kind of started off asking Mr. Good how and why he first came to Los Angeles.
My mother always told me when I was a little boy, said, "I don't want you to live here in the South." She said, "And when you leave here from the South," she said, "go west." She said, "Don't go east." She said, "Make sure that you don't go to Mississippi and Louisiana." So I came west,
mm-hmm.
and I end up in California.
Jobs like in the longshore industry are ones that traditionally have been considered good-paying jobs, but also ones that are not very friendly to black folks. So what did you find when you first started as a casual?
It wasn't friendly. It wasn't friendly. It wasn't easy. It was hard. But it wasn't too hard for me because I was from the South anyway, and it was hard there. So when I got here, I was used to it. Everything hard, you got it. Everything dangerous, you got it. They didn't feel that a black man could operate those jobs. They didn't want us to have the job because it was paying a skill pay, more money. That's what I looked at, you know. Didn't want you to pick up the jobs out of the hall, or when you do get them out, you come out on the job site. Well, the men didn't want to work underneath you, underneath the crane, because it was a black man driving it, a black man driving the winches and all that old kind of crap, you know. That's how they would respond to you. They would go for the walk off the job. They'd reap out, leave, you know, miss a night's pay, you know, to keep from working under a black man.
Do you think things have gotten better?
Yes, they have. They've gotten better, like, you know, black men are just stepping on up to the plate and taking the jobs and going to work and making a living and ignoring them.
Clovey Jean, what about black women?
It was a struggle for us. You know, we had to stand up. A lot of women maybe walked away from the job, you know, didn't want to ever come back on the waterfront. But as a whole, if you stayed and you worked it out and you learned your job and you applied yourself, you could advance. Personally, I stayed focused on what I wanted, and I went forward with it and opened up the doors for other women to come in behind me, you know, just stuck to it. And my father always told me, you go down that waterfront, you can be anybody you want to be. You just got to apply yourself and don't take no wooden nickels.
There's not a lot to go around at this point. Not a lot of work, not a lot of people buying goods. Are you thinking that your industry, let alone your position, is secure at this moment in America's history?
Right now, the industry, less ships are coming in. You know, where we used to work 7 days a week, or now we're cut back now maybe to 5 to 4 days. But like everything, it will pass.
It's just a matter of time. I've saw it happen lots of time there, that it got down to 2 days a week, you know, and it came back around. It just goes and comes. It's not going to stay away.
So what was it, Zach, that really drew you to these people and their story?
Well, I think it was just the toughness of this father-daughter duo and their optimism as well. And, you know, as Farai noted, and this was a few months ago at this point, it's tough times down there on the docks. And word is now that they are down to 2 days a week work.
Zach, good job. Thank you.
Thank you, Tony.
That was Zachary Slobig, one of our producers here at News and Notes, talking about one of his favorite segments, the story of a father and daughter, both longshoremen here in Los Angeles. That's our show for today. Glad you could join us. To listen to the show or to visit the website, visit us at nprnewsandnotes.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium.